Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to poets Debbie Brody and Lauren Camp, and we're also going to have a commentary from Ron Bloomberg. Right now, I'd like to welcome anthropologist John Kantner. He's the vice president of the School for Advanced Research, formerly known as the School of American Research, and he's author of the book Ancient Puebloan Southwest, published by Cambridge University Press. He'll be speaking on Thursday at 8 o'clock at the James A. Little Theater, sponsored by the School for Advanced Research. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
It's great to have you here. Now, Ancient Puebloan Southwest, that's basically, we're sort of in the middle of the region that you describe in your book.
That's correct.
And human habitation of this region goes back 12,000 years?
At least that long, yes.
What do we know about the very first people here?
Well, the classic understanding of the first people to enter the Southwest would be the classic big game hunters who would be hunting the large megafauna that would have roamed this area back in the time period at the very end of the Pleistocene, when it would have been, area would have been covered with lakes and forests, and it was much moister than it is now.
I love the word megafauna.
Yes, megafauna. That would be mammoth. There would be animals such as a camel horse, which were indigenous to the area at the time, and this provided plentiful food for people that were entering this area, presumably having originated in Siberia and moved across the Bering Strait and then down into what is now the Southwest. So the classic understanding is that they would have been these big game hunters, although now archaeologists are realizing they probably also ate a whole plethora of other foods, plant food, smaller animals. The archaeological record is biased because we find the big stuff, the big bones that are left over, and not the smaller things.
As I was looking through your book, I just kept thinking over and over again, how in the world do they know? Because everybody can find pots and tools and arrowheads, but once you start talking about things like what they ate, organic matter that returns to the earth, or what they thought, you're getting into ground that seems almost impossible.
Sure. Well, that actually, when I started out my academic career, I wanted to be an evolutionary biologist, or actually going into medicine was a backup plan. But the sort of puzzle aspect of doing archaeology was just so inviting to me, and trying to figure out what people were doing so long ago based on this incomplete record of their past behavior. It really is a great intellectual challenge to figure out these kinds of details, and in many cases we have to make inferences that maybe aren't the strongest, but there are many clever, creative ways to discover things about the past.
So when people think about ancient indigenous civilizations, they often have this idea that there's a sort of unchanging, primordial, close to the earth, you know, maybe happy, maybe violent people. But you describe periods of intense cultural change that go on, you know, century after century, millennium after millennium. So when you go back to 12,000 years ago, what kind of evolution happened, and what were the drivers of cultural change?
Right. Okay. Well, that's a great question. That's my book really is focused upon, or one of the themes that comes out of this book is the idea that people in the past were really not that much different than people today. And so that means that just like today, there are lots of factors that influence how we change. Some of those factors are just the way that humans are, some of the basic human nature, and this includes violence, cooperation, you know, concerns about each other. Those are certainly important factors that would have influenced people in the past, just like today. And then to throw into the mix, of course, is the environmental context and the social context in which we live. And so the environment, of course, is constantly changing. And people respond to that in various ways according to their own interests and their own cultural precepts.
Now, you also have changes in the amount of population. During a wet period with abundant food, you're going to have population growth. Then when there's a change in climate, you've got problems.
That's right. One of the lessons that we see from the past, just like we can sort of anticipate today, is that as populations grow, they're going to do that during a time period when things are really quite pleasant and there's lots of opportunity, and people see that there's no end to the richness of the environment, and so they tend to overextend themselves and don't really anticipate so well what might happen far into the future. And something ultimately is going to change, and the environment will change, there'll be a crisis, or just the continual population growth will lead to stresses that force people to make adjustments. And that doesn't mean that people just all die off, it just means that they have to change how they interact with one another and with the environment. And that, I think, is one of the clear lessons that you see in the Puebloan Southwest, because this is a place where, as we know today, the climate has such a tremendous impact.
Well, one of the things you talk about is because it's so dry here, there's a much greater opportunity for archaeological preservation, and so we actually can know more.
That's right. Yeah, that's one of the wonderful things about working here. I had done quite a bit of work in Central America, and one of the challenges there is that the preservation is not nearly as good, so you can't really marshal all the different sources of evidence to figure out what happened in the past. Here in the Southwest, you really can.
So what were some of the actual specific ways in which changes in climate played out, and then how do you figure out what actually happened?
Sure. Well, my specific area of expertise is in the Chacoan culture, of which was centered in Chaco Canyon, and that had influence over a vast area of the Puebloan Southwest, both across space and through time. And one of the lessons about this particular phenomenon is that they were expanding during a time period which was quite wet in the grand scheme of southwestern paleoclimate. And they expanded to such a degree that as soon as the environment began to change, even just a little bit, it didn't have to take a huge change, but just even a small change was enough to make things extremely challenging for them. And so the way that I often describe it is that the Chacoan society built up this house of cards of great complexity, taking tremendous energy in order to feed it. And then as soon as the climate changed, then the whole thing fell apart quite rapidly. And that is something we see repeating several times in the Southwest.
What was the change in climate?
Well, what we see is that the Chacoan society began to emerge as sort of a distinctive phenomenon in the late 9th century. And this is a time period when people had already become full-time farmers. They already were living in above-ground masonry architecture. And they had invested in overproducing food, because this is one of the ways that you adapt to the instability of the Southwest, is that you make sure that you produce as much as you possibly can and store it for those years when things aren't so good.
So it's the survivalists of 1,000 years ago.
It was the survivalists of 1,000 years ago, and it makes perfect sense, because you just don't know from year to year, just as we see here in Santa Fe, you don't know from year to year what the rainfall is going to be like. So you just overproduce. Now what happens is, during a time period when things are continually good year after year after year, they're continuing to overproduce because that's what they're geared towards, but their storehouses are filling up further and further. And you have to do something with that. And what happened in the case of Chaco Canyon is they began to invest into large-scale architecture, ultimately building this really elaborate pilgrimage center that drew people from hundreds of miles around. And they continued to build this up, massive architecture, incredible investment, carrying hundreds of thousands of logs across the desert in order to build this architecture, trading with over long distances for macaws, for copper bells, for turquoise, for shell. And this continued to be elaborated until the pattern of climate improvement began to disappear. And it wasn't that phenomenal of a change. It happened around the early 1100s, and they begin to not be able to produce quite as much, and not nearly as much as they needed to sustain that same momentum. And so things quickly collapse. They just can't get the macaws anymore. They can't get all the huge log beams across the desert anymore. They can't invest in the entire phenomenon, and so it just fades away.
We're talking to John Kantner. His book is called Ancient Puebloan Southwest, and at 8 o'clock on Thursday, he'll be speaking at the James A. Little Theater about Chaco Canyon, about this whole area. Now, without refrigeration, how did they store food?
Well, let's see. The storage, what they focused upon, is food that was easily storable, so that's going to be maize in particular. Because you can dry, of course, the corn cobs, or take the corn off and store the corn. And this can actually last for many, many years. So as long as you can protect it from moisture, which is usually not a terrible problem in the Southwest to protect fruit from moisture. And as long as you can protect it from other vermin that might want that food, then you can keep that for quite a long period of time. So that's what people tended to store. And other foods that may not be so storable, like pinion nuts or obviously game or other kinds of plant foods, that's the stuff you eat right away. You keep the corn for sort of backup food.
So when we talk about the word Puebloan refers to a pueblo, refers to building, refers to architecture. This elaborate architecture, which we still see signs of in the way we build our buildings here in Santa Fe today, became so elaborate primarily because of food storage?
Well, okay, that's a good question. If we go back to when people first begin to farm, they are living in below-ground pit structures. And this makes a lot of sense in the Southwest because during the winter, those below-ground pit structures, they protect you from the cold. And, of course, during the summer, they provide insulation against the heat. But they're not so great for storing food in. You just can't keep on piling food into these big holes in the ground because then, of course, animals can get into it. It takes a lot of effort to do that. So they began to construct above-ground architecture, the masonry architecture that is famous for, that the Puebloans are famous for. And this above-ground architecture then becomes the focus of domestic life in Puebloan society. Now, in Chaco Canyon, what they do is they take the idea of this above-ground architecture and they turn it into these monumental structures that probably were not used for storage but were big just for the sake of being big. If you're going to construct a pilgrimage center, you need phenomenal monuments for people to come and experience. And so
cathedrals.
Cathedrals, exactly. So what we see as the great houses in Chaco Canyon are the equivalent of cathedrals or monuments you'll see in any pilgrimage center across the world today and in prehistory. And so that's what they're doing. They're building these huge structures. Probably they weren't fully used for storage or domestic residence. Instead, they were just built for the sake of having something huge there, and they just kept on building them until, again, the wheels came off with the minor drought that all of a sudden people weren't so interested in investing in this pilgrimage center.
Now, pilgrimage suggests a whole religious orientation. Where were the pilgrims coming from? What were they coming to? What was the religious structure?
Right, that's a good question. That is one of the focal points of my research, is trying to figure out why people would want to involve themselves in a pilgrimage center. Because, of course, as a pilgrim, you are often required to invest in the center. You bring food, you invest your labor in it. And so the question is, what do you receive in return? In the case of Chaco Canyon, it's pretty certain that people are bringing pottery, they're bringing beams, they're contributing their labor, they're probably bringing food into the canyon, but nothing really is going out in a material sense. Instead, people are going there for the religious experience. And that religious experience probably was related to the same themes that we see in Puebloan society today, and that is the clerical rituals that are so important for farmers. Keeping track of things like solstice events, equinoxes, changes in as the sun passes through the sky over the year. In an environment like the Southwest, which is arid but also can be quite cold, you have to worry about the growing season and when to plant and when to harvest. And a lot of the religious activity is going to be related to that. And Chaco Canyon, I think, really seized into that. They built all these archaeoastronomical features that were designed to observe the passage of the heavens. And
so there's some place you can stand on the solstice and the sun shines through
crack. Chaco Canyon is full of those kinds of features. And that seems to be what people tend to know the most about Chaco Canyon. There are features like the sun dagger, the alignments of the buildings, all of it, the entire landscape there, both built landscape and the actual landscape, is oriented towards this understanding of the passage of time in a cyclical fashion, which is so important for farmers.
And so people did rituals around those times, those seasons.
That's the idea, exactly. And the evidence is pretty compelling towards that interpretation.
Does some of that evidence come from observing contemporary culture, observing Indians of the last 100 years?
Sure, yeah. The ethnographic record of Puebloan society today provides us with a lot of the means for interpreting what happened in the past. And that includes the importance of the cyclical calendar, the seasonal calendar, The importance of the farming sequences. These are all things which are critical to Puebloan people historically and today. And we extend that back into the past to make the same interpretations of what happened 1,000 years ago. Now, one of the problems with this is often you have to be cautious as an archaeologist not to simply take the ethnography of, say, 1845 and impose it on 900 AD. And so that's a challenge that archaeologists have, is drawing lessons from Puebloan people today, but also understanding that change happened in the past just like it happens today. And we can't just picture the Puebloan people of 1,000 years ago as being mirror copies of the Puebloan people historically in the Southwest.
We're talking to John Kantner. What were some of the basic technologies that people used, and what were some of the technological inventions and revolutions that happened over these thousands of years you're looking at?
Oh, gosh. The kinds of developments that you're going to see in that regard, a lot of it surrounds pottery, because, of course, pottery is one thing that we find in the archaeological record. We have a good understanding of how pottery changes through time. And a lot of those changes include how pottery is made in order to provide the maximum amount of storage, in order to make sure the pottery doesn't break when it's being heated, when you're cooking with it. And there's also technological changes that reflect how people want to decorate their pottery. So, for example, the earliest pottery tends to be these white wares that are painted with basic organic or mineral paints. But as time goes on, people want newer kinds of pottery. They need different looks to their pottery. And so a lot of the developments that we see on the archaeological record reflect this. So we have, for example, the use of glazewares that replace some of the earlier organic decorations on the pottery. So these are some of the technological changes that we see. But in general, Puebloan society, you don't see a tremendous amount of technological change. I mean, they had a system that worked very well for adapting to the Puebloan Southwest. They certainly experimented with irrigation, different ways of doing agriculture, and we see quite a bit of evidence of that. But generally, things worked quite well, and so there's not a tremendous amount of momentum towards technological change.
And I suppose that's one of the significant differences between that culture and our own, which is so geared toward continually changing its technology.
Well, I think that's true, and part of that has to do with the phenomenal growth of populations today and the need to constantly be changing technology to keep up with that. But also part of it actually goes back to what I was describing in reference to the need for new looks to pottery. A lot of our technology today is not so much to make life easier or to make it easier to extract energy from the environment. A lot of it is just to have cooler, newer stuff that we can put into our living rooms. And to, I think, a significant degree, you see seeds of that even in the Puebloan prehistory 1,000 years ago, people doing these same kinds of things. They wanted something new that would distinguish them from other people in their social environment.
When you talk about Chaco Canyon, you talk about a society that for a time was really expanding. Was there what we think of as governmental control over the areas toward which into which it was expanding?
That's one of my, another area of my research is focusing upon how we can look at buildings and we can see big buildings and we can see pottery change, but what does that mean as far as how people interacted with one another? And I think that what you see is that there are, within any Puebloan village, there certainly are leaders, probably have some rule within the ceremonial rituals of that particular community, and they form alliances with one another, they interact with one another, but we don't see that there are anything equivalent of kings or any other kind of entity that would have widespread control over a large area of the Southwest. Instead, village autonomy or regional autonomy is one of the continuing themes, and that's actually a continuing theme in humans in general. People just don't like to give up their decision-making abilities to others, and only when forced to do so does that happen. In the Southwest, you see the same thing.
Now, it's interesting because in one of the themes in your book, when you talk about leadership, is decision-making. What kind of decisions needed to be made?
Well, the kinds of decisions that need to be made are generally regarding, of course, the farming cycle. You need to know when to plant, you need to know when to harvest. the most successful farming takes place when people cooperate in that regard. And so some kind of collaborative decision making is going to of course benefit farmers in that way. You also, of course, have to deal with the fact that there are lots of other people in your social environment. And so you need to figure out how to interact with the village next door. You need to figure out how you're going to get, say, volcanic glass from some long distance away, because that's the best kind of tool. And so there's decision making that has to be done on that scale. And that's, I think, where you see some of these early leaders within these villages taking some authority. They both have some influence over what takes place within the community as far as the farming cycle, but they also are responsible in various ways of trying to establish relationships to get the goodies from far away.
We're talking to John Cantner. There were periods of real violence and conflict, and I was wondering what the Puebloan Southwest is a big place, lots of communities, lots of groups. Did they speak the same language? Were they the same ethnicity, whatever that means in that context?
Sure. Well, the answer to the last two questions as far as the same ethnicity and the same language is no. They weren't the same ethnic groups. They weren't the same. They didn't have the same languages. And we know this because we can see today that there are different languages that Puebloan people speak, that the distinctions between them have great time depth in the Southwest. So a lot of the language differences must have happened a long time ago. And
Even though they have the same roots in Siberia, presumably.
Right. And, well, you can make the same argument going all the way back to, say, Africa, that we all have the same roots in Africa, but
obviously they're
quite distinct. And that, you know, I would argue, of course, is part of human nature, is that we tend to distinguish ourselves from one another in the complex social environments in which humans exist.
Or even simple environments,
like an
elementary school.
That's right, exactly. We tend to form our little cliques, and you can see it from the small scale of human society to the larger scales. And that's certainly the case in the Southwest. And so there's going to be different groups all over the place. We tend to refer to them as the Puebloan groups because they do share some cultural traits. They live in above ground architecture. They're farmers. They, just like all farmers, they pay attention to the passage of the sun. So there's a lot of cultural traits that they share, but of course they saw
and some similarity in their art.
And there's some similarity in their art as well, but there also, you will see differences in pottery across the Southwest, the Puebloan Southwest, and as well as rock art. So there's similarities and differences, just as you see for all humans. And they're all quite distinct. That doesn't mean necessarily that they're warring with one another all the time, or that there's this continual theme of violence. Certainly in the last decade or so, that's been a major theme in what the press picks up about the Puebloan Southwest, because there's been a few books that have been published about warfare in the Southwest. There have been a few books that were published about cannibalism in the Southwest. But in essence, people in the Puebloan Southwest were no different than, say, you know, people in Europe or people in South Africa or people in Australia at any given moment in time.
So what were the types of events, do you think, that led to conflicts when there were conflicts?
Well, same thing that you see today. So sometimes it's over food, but more often than not, it's simply over disagreements between groups, long-standing feuds between neighboring villages. It runs the gamut of the same things we see today. In various points in time, for example, after the collapse of Chaco Canyon, there's a political vacuum that leads to a lot of conflict, some of which is violent. And that's simply as political and social relationships are being sort of renegotiated after that 800-pound gorilla that some archaeologists consider Chaco to be. After that disappeared, then people were, okay, well, what do we do now? Who's going to be in charge now? So we see conflict as those negotiations take place, and that includes warfare. Now, at other times, some of the conflict is related to environmental crisis and people trying to find food. And we see that as well in the Puebloan Southwest, just like we see it anywhere else in the world.
I would think that the study of anthropology and archaeology inevitably has biases of the student and biases of the time built into it. And looking back, say, 100 years or to the roots of early archaeology and anthropology, it's very easy to see those biases, but it's very hard to see one's own in one's own time. How do you deal with that? How do you think about it?
Right. Yeah, that's a problem that, of course, historians have, archaeologists have. Anybody who looks at the past inevitably has to interpret the past through the lenses of the present. We have no way to independently go back and figure out exactly what was taking place. And even if we were, even as people observe the world around them today, they interpret it through the lens of their own experience. So for archaeologists, this is historically, you can see this pattern. You can see that sometimes when America is engaged in lots of violent interactions, then we tend to emphasize violent interactions in the past. When American culture is focused upon cooperation and peace, then often that's the way that we interpret things in the past. And that's a challenge for archaeologists, because we like to try as much as possible to have some objective understanding of what happened. And so insofar as that's possible, we do that through the marshaling of as much evidence as possible. And I think, most importantly, a real understanding of how your own biases are being brought to bear upon your interpretations of the past. And I think that sort of reflexive understanding of your position as a researcher, and understanding what it is that you want to see about the past, and using that to judge your interpretations, I think, is an important part of being a scholar.
I would think also, I mean, a huge part of anthropology is studying gender roles. What was the role of men and women in any time? Are there many women archaeologists, anthropologists looking at this time and place?
Sure, absolutely. And there have been many books that have been published on gender in the Pueblo and Southwest. And archaeologically, again, that's difficult to identify gender roles. And one way that we tend to do that is to look at burials or burial contexts, because that's when you can really associate a sex of a buried individual with the material remains that are found with them. And so there have been a number of studies that have focused upon that. Many of the themes of research that archaeologists have focused on is figuring out, for example, were past societies in the Southwest, were they matrilineal, were they patrilineal? We know today, for example, that many Pueblan groups are matrilineal, and when did that happen? Is that, how far back in time does that go?
And those do we know?
Well, that's difficult to determine. There are various studies that have focused, for example, on burials that show that females in Pueblan society in the not-so-distant past, that they have the same kinds of burial goods found with them as males have with them. Sometimes even richer burials are female burials. And so that suggests that perhaps matrilineal society in the Pueblo and Southwest goes back a considerable ways. And I think there's pretty compelling evidence towards that. When we get further and further into the past, and as the evidence gets scantier and scantier, then the interpretations get harder to make.
Now, you spoke a while ago about the fascination of putting together the pieces of a puzzle, and that's part of what fascinates archaeologists. And I can imagine that, although, you know, I think it must be really a calling to want to do that. But what does the study of archaeology bring to the general reader, to the general population? I would think we have so much to learn from our past, although it's not clear that we would ever actually absorb the lessons in any
right.
real way.
That's a good point. One of the compelling things about being an archaeologist is that you have access to a vast database of human behavior. It's not a complete database, but we have, you know, all the way from the formation of the very first humans as a species, all the way into up to today, and we have access to societies from across every continent in the world. So we really, I think, more so than almost any other discipline, have some idea about what humans are like. At least we should have that kind of idea, because we have such a vast database. And that's one of the main interests that I have in archaeology. As an anthropologist, I'm interested in human nature. I'm interested in what it is that humans do. I'm interested in why humans change. I'm interested in the problems that humans experience. And we can look at that in every single continent and every single time period to figure out how people have responded to opportunity, to crisis, to dealing with one another.
Can you funnel that to the people in Congress?
Yeah, actually, archaeologists have been pretty bad about that, and I think anthropologists in general, is that we generate these lessons from the past, but we aren't so good at disseminating that information. And that actually was one of the motivations for writing this book, is that in this book I'm making this major argument that there are major lessons from the past that we should and can learn. And trying to get that to policymakers, that is more of a challenge for archaeologists. Our major role in policymaking is the preservation of cultural patrimony. We try to, of course, help to enact laws that preserve archaeological resources under the argument that, of course, that this can provide us information about the past that is useful for today. We've never been quite so good at actually developing those arguments in a way which is consumable by policymakers. So I think it's a challenge for our discipline, and anthropology in general has that challenge.
But your book is a step attempting to go in that direction.
It is, because I've moved out of my myopic studies on this one particular time period in a very small part of the world and tried to extend it to sort of broader lessons about humanity.
The book is called Ancient Puebloan Southwest by John Kantner. John Kantner is vice president of the School for Advanced Research, and the book is published by Cambridge University Press. He'll be speaking on Thursday, this Thursday, the day after tomorrow, at 8 o'clock at the James A. Little Theater, and we look forward to seeing you there.
Thank you very much.
And thanks for being with us. We're going to hear a commentary now from Ron Bloomberg, and when we come back, we'll be speaking with Lauren Camp and Debbie Brody. Stay tuned to KSFR.
It's Ron Bloomberg, just a voice in the crowd. There's a political cartoon in Sunday's New York Times by Mike Lukovich that pictured a very large Karl Rove bringing a very small George Bush the latest good news. The caption reads, "Hooray! The United States attorney scandal is eclipsing the Scooter Libby debacle that's totally clouding the Walter Reed disgrace." Talk about the gang that couldn't shoot straight. Karl Rove, what a piece of work. His illustrious career started at 21 when he was doing dirty tricks for Donald Segretti, the Nixon strategist. Then he worked with Lee Atwater, another prince of a fellow. But Rove has brought sleazeball gutter politics to an art form. Over the years, he's speared Ed Muskie, Shirley Chisholm, Dukakis, Carter, Kerry, and he's an equal opportunity smearer, spreading outlandish lies about John McCain in 2004. A good bumper sticker I recently saw about Rove and the outing of Valerie Plame read, "Bush's brain's been leaking." It's not only leaking, it's turning to mush. The spinmeister is losing his curveball. It's the Democrats who now control Congress, and his patron Saint Bush has just hit a new low of 30 in the public opinion polls. Well, to cheer him up, I dug out at great expense what I think should be the theme song of the one and only Karl Rove.
How could you believe me when I said I love you, when you know I've been a liar all my life?
You've had that reputation since you was a youth.
You must have been insane to think I'd tell you the truth.
Talk to you next week, if you have a minute.
KSFR's Ron Bloomberg can be heard each Tuesday on the Radio Cafe, Thursdays before the news at noon, and Saturdays after Bob Edwards, just before the 10 o'clock hour. KSFR programming is underwritten in part by Garcia Street Books, located at 376 Garcia Street, where Santa Fe living treasure Marcia Muth will launch A World Set Apart, Memory Paintings, on Friday, March 23rd at 5 p.m. And on Saturday, March 24th at 5 p.m., John Agresto will celebrate his national book launch of Mugged by Reality, The Liberation of Iraq and the Failure of Good Intentions. More information at 986-0151 or garciastreetbooks.com.
It's tax time, and your friends at the Santa Fe Community College are once again offering free tax preparation for seniors and families with incomes under $40,000. Bring your tax papers to the college, and our students and volunteers will electronically prepare and file your federal and state returns. As always, our service is free. We still need volunteers to help with our Spanish-speaking clients. Call 428-1780 for more details or taxhelpsf.org.
In touch with our community, KSFR, Santa Fe Public Radio.
I'd like now to welcome poets Lauren Camp and Debbie Brody. They are going to be reading tonight at Theater Work. It's a two-person reading called Entwined. It's free and open to the public. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
Thanks.
Now, Entwined, that's, let me guess, it's about relationships?
It is about relationships. The poems are primarily about relationships, and it's also about how we're reading. We're doing something, I think, a little different for a poetry reading. We are pretty much going back and forth, interspersing Debbie's poems and my poems back and forth throughout the whole evening.
Now, this is something, have you been writing together, familiar with each other's work, reading together for a while?
Lauren and I have been writing together for 6 or 7 years, and we discovered a lot of synchronicities in our work in terms of content and in terms of the way we treat the visual world in our written words.
Now, are you an artist as well?
Thank goodness, no, I do not have the artist curse, but I do own an art gallery, so I hope none of my artists heard me say that.
So you're involved with art, and Lauren, you, of course, maybe our regular listeners will
I
know this,
that
are
curse.
An artist. You do have the artist.
I'm fine with that.
Let's call it a gift.
It is. Actually, I just read an article recently about Tony Bennett, who, you know, he sings and he paints, and he said it's great to have the one thing to go back to when you're tired of singing. You can go to painting and go back and forth, and then you've always got something creative, which I agree with.
Now, when you, the two of you have been working together for 6 or 7 years, and I've heard people in Santa Fe say, often, especially who are poets, say, I write with so-and-so. Now, that seems like you might really be rubbing off on one another, too, in terms of the way you approach writing and in terms of the way you write.
Just like our reading is a bouncing off of one another in terms of content, when you write in a group, you're inspired, just like people go to museums to look at a piece of art to go home and paint, only it's much more immediate. It's happening as you're sitting at a table together, sharing concepts and thoughts and rhythm even.
Yeah, and I actually think that it doesn't come out as similar sound, because you bring your own voice to it, you bring your own feelings, your own whatever's going on in your day. But Debbie's right, it does give you a chance to pick up on something that you might not have considered writing on or writing about.
Now, you are, as our listeners may know, the Monday morning jazz DJ. Your show is called The Colors of Jazz, and you're also an artist. How much is your poetry influenced by jazz, do you think?
Oh, maybe completely. I don't know. By rhythm, by melody, it's very influenced by the meter of the music that I listen to.
Have you ever set any of your poetry to music or thought about doing so?
I've thought about it. I've read with backing from, like, the Southwest Jazz Orchestra and other musicians, and I love doing that. And I haven't set any of my poetry to music, but every Monday morning on my show, I read a poem with music behind it. Not my poems, but
now,
I love that part of it.
We're talking to Lauren Camp and Debbie Brody, and they're going to be reading tonight at 7 o'clock at Theater Work on Rufina Circle, a wonderful little space, too.
It's a beautiful space.
What, 50-something people can fit in there?
Maybe. Actually, it might be like 80 or something. It's a little black box theater that they have done. Paula and David Olson have done a phenomenal job of turning this garage into a tremendous intimate theater.
Was that what it was, a garage?
Yeah, it was a garage. So.
I love that industrial neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we do a little bit of reading? Why don't you go back and forth with a couple of poems?
Okay, let's see if... Okay. I'll start with...
Debbie Brody.
Go ahead.
Reminders from Cheetah. Cheetah says, the answers may not be within, but only a lighting for a moment inside. Cheetah says, these are not tears running down my face. They are tattoos, stained reminders of what was and what can be. Cheetah says, remember the colors of our watery globe reflected in the wings of a morpho butterfly. Remember the smell of soft earth in the folds of a baby's neck. Remember day and night are an artificial separation, a ritual abandonment. Cheetah says, love is the highest survival instinct. Crawl inside my limbs. Walk softly in padded paws. Bless the lion when he pounces on my young. The red water of their blood feeds his unconceived children. Cross the river of yourself to become the cloud that was the ocean. Thank you.
Debbie Brody. Okay, go ahead, Lauren Camp.
All right, I'll read a poem called The Story of Your Body. It talks to you in whispers and angles of pain, jutting disintegration of muscle and fat. Let your back spoon to the right at one juncture. Lean its curved form in to hear the stories of your body. Let your knees lock, ankles buckle, fingers bend into themselves. Scratch silent fear inside each palm like a heartbeat to the unknown. Use ink to organize your layers, front and back. Noise to permeate the joints. Let your ribs clatter like broken wood. Let yourself be lost. Unbury bones of gentle smiles. Become a windmill revolving over copper castles. Of course pain remains, like magical destruction. Make your body swallow it.
Lauren Camp. Do you want to read another one? You want to
sure.
do a little bit more entwining?
I was thinking about Lauren's influence so much by music. And my rhythm, I think, was really informed by Dr. Seuss. So I'll read this.
Yay.
Dr. Seuss. In fourth grade, she was kicked out of Brownies. Never prepared. Patches not sewn on sashes. Brown socks not purchased. Her oldest sister, 14, had run away again. Her parents stunned into immobility again. They were the ones the neighbors talked about again. 1 week, two, no call from a police department in some small Indiana town. 3 weeks, four, no call from parents of a friend, no clue to follow. 5 weeks, six, she's picked up in Harlem, selling her lice-covered body, weight 82 pounds. Police departments from New York to Chicago pass her from station house to station house. Week seven, she tells her baby sister about the powdered eggs they lived on, 12 in that small Harlem flat. They cook up green, like in the Dr. Seuss book. Our favorite one, she says, the one we both know by heart.
Now, what was the origin of that poem?
You know, I think people assume when they listen to poems nowadays, since the confessional poets of Sylvia Plath's days, that these are stories about our own lives. And I would say that when Lauren and I write, half of it might be something that resembles our lives, certainly something that is equal to the truth, but may not in fact be about us. It could be about an imagined life. It could be about someone we saw in a movie. It could be something that we read. So the origins kind of fuse. So yes, some of this was taken from my life, but some of it was taken from somebody else's life and kind of glued together the way that we glue together our writing.
I was expecting something more Seuss-like, and it got dark. It got dark very quick.
Well, yeah. That's actually a poem that Debbie's reading tonight. And when we sat down in the past couple of months and put together what we sort of a playlist, what we were going to read, and it was very interesting because I was looking at the title of that and said, "Oh, Dr. Seuss, read that because I'm going to read something upbeat." And she started reading it, and I was like, "Ouch, it's hard."
Not so upbeat.
No.
Let's hear another one from you, Lauren Camp.
Okay, counting. One day you will return to catalog my progress in this world. Two times I will smile, though I may not know you anymore. 3 hours will elapse as we search the earth for comfort. 4,000 people will cross paths in a city far away, 5 times around the world. We will drive there to see the marks they leave behind. We'll bring 6 dreams to the table. I will tell you mine first. You will remind me that almost 7 years have passed. Study me for lines of disbelief. 8 times I will kiss you and the space you leave behind. 9 times you will bend to stroke my hair, and 9 times 9 you will cover me with prayers. On the 10th day we will balance on our heads. look sideways into each other's biggest, brownest eyes, as though looking into a mirror of ourselves.
Lauren Camp, now, when you do a poetry reading, are you concerned with putting out your newest work? Are you taking stuff from your past? How do you craft that?
Well, what we did is, certainly this is my book release party as well, so I'm going to try to read, and I am going to read probably half of the selections from my book. But like most artists, we always like what we've just finished best.
Or we hate it.
So we do have some of those newer works, and also some really older works, just because of the way they intertwined with each other's writing. So.
Now, your new book is called Portraits in Poetry.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of portraits are we talking about?
Mostly portraits of individuals. The first half of the book describes individuals, essentially, and then the latter part of the book, maybe less than half, is relationship paintings, or in words. There are no paintings in the book, don't be confused. Other than the cover, which is actually a painting my mother did of me when I was 14. And of the three paintings she's ever done of me, every one of them I'm holding a book in my hands. So this is coming.
This is was poetry an early passion for you?
Yeah. I recently had a radio interview in Colorado. I was doing a workshop at a festival there. And she asked me when I wrote my first poem, and I know this sounds very contrived, but it was in chalk on the sidewalk, age 3. And it really was modeled after Dr. Seuss. So.
Chicks with bricks come, chicks with blocks come.
You got it.
What about you, Lauren? Have you been writing poetry since you were 3 years old with chalk on the sidewalk?
No. I don't actually know when I started writing poems. As a little girl, I did a lot of collage art with whatever I could find in my house. We had virtually no art supplies, so if I could find some colored paper, that was great. If I could find some of my mom's old magazines to cut up, that was great. And so I used words, and I'd write these poems, these rhyming poems to my brother as birthday cards, things like that. And in fact, Debbie reminded me recently that, oh yeah, when I first started writing what I considered poems as an adult, they were rhyming poems. And I got over it.
When you say you got over it, what's wrong with rhyming poems?
Nothing. I think I just worked through it, and I was pretty interested in the slam poetry movement, and yet I realized that some of that is rhyming poems, but there's also a lot of anger, and I don't have any anger. You know, I'm not writing out of anger. So,
ladies and gentlemen, she doesn't have any anger.
Well, not usually, actually.
a unique individual on the planet.
Stress, exhaustion, but not anger.
Lauren Camp and Debbie Brody are going to be reading tonight. The poetry reading is called Entwined. It's at Theater Work at 7 o'clock. It's free and open to the public. Do you work with forms such as sonnets, such as sestinas, whatever poetry forms we have from the history of the English language?
I do, I think, a little bit more than Lauren does, and particularly if I'm tackling a huge and enormous and emotionally wrought subject and I need to contain it. Plucking out a form really helps me contain it. I love the pantoum, which is really originally an ancient Urdu form, which the Chinese claimed as some form. I love that repetition in the pantoum. And a sestina is really good if you have a big, scary story to tell. And yes, you're correct. Most of my poems aren't very pretty in the sense of poetry, so I do often tell scary, big, scary stories and need a form to put them in.
I think, and we've talked about this on the show in different ways, but I think it's always worth repeating and thinking about that a tight form can contain an unwieldy emotion.
Exactly. That's what I was trying to
say. I don't know
say.
Why that is.
Yeah. Well, it forces you to pluck out the meat of the situation, to put it in those structured words rather than just flowing with the sensations that are coming out.
I think parameters always help in things. Like, otherwise the world's too big and open, and this form gives you a way to say what you're trying to say without getting off on too many tangents or just organizing.
Yeah.
Just
getting to the essential
yeah.
part of it, naming it.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, the time has come. It's wonderful to have you both on the air, and we look forward to seeing you tonight at 7 o'clock at Theater Work. Once again, the event is called Entwined, and it's free, and it is also the local book release for Debbie Brody's Portraits in Poetry, which is from Village Books Press in Oklahoma, new book. And it's also the first reading from Lauren Camp's manuscript, Undoing. So, and people can also ask questions and make comments and things like
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely.
Good, good.
I love it.
Well, thank you for being here with us on KSFR.
Thanks so much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Hoedown. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Thank you so much for listening to Santa Fe's only public radio station, KSFR. Ciao.